because I believe that by doing science, we find God. Now, notice, again, that you can... what he's doing there is he's integrating his findings from both science and theology, right? Because science can only take you so far, but it does strongly implicate an immense intelligence that's behind this. And then when you look at, in the field of theology, evidence of God having acted in human history and who is he and what has he done, then you can fill in the details, right? Through that. So... okay, so back to the PowerPoint.
What's the probability of there being more than one God then?
That the probability of comparing monotheism with polytheism, I don't think can be addressed through science. It has to be addressed through philosophy, history, and theology. Looking at the human history, what has happened in human history, what evidence do we have of God actually communicating with us, and what has he said about himself? Okay, so let's pick up where we left.
That was a great clip, by the way.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, again, the movie's called The Case for a Creator.
Go to
discovery.org, and you can order it. Or another website that has actually an easier way to order materials is arn.org for Access Research Network. arn.org is a great place to easily to order lots of stuff. They're one of our... sort of companion websites that with Discovery Institute. Yeah, that's Peter Ward. I'll talk about him in a moment.
What was the name of the film?
This one's called The Case for a Creator, the one I showed you a clip of. This one covers the life sciences and the physical sciences, and this is the most compact movie that covers the entire argument for intelligent design in all the major fields in one movie. There's a couple of movies that go into more detail into, let's say, the physical sciences. The best one there is called The Privileged Planet. I mentioned that. And then the one that goes best into the life sciences is called Unlocking the Mystery of Life. And that one actually played on numerous PBS stations across the country. Government TV. Actually made it into government TV. Yeah, so...
Are any of these getting into the schools?
I think that, okay, as far as public education goes, in Christian education, Discovery Institute has helped to market some of these intelligent design movies and curriculum to Christian and private education. In public education, what we're particularly interested in seeing happen is the case for and against Darwinism being taught more thoroughly and fairly. And so we have a curriculum that does not teach design, but teaches only the strengths and weaknesses of Darwinism. It's called Explore Evolution. There's a book, and then I was the primary author of the teacher auxiliary materials that go with the book, and it's being marketed to public schools, including in the state of Texas. Our state board of education has enacted some of the finest science standards in the country, and that's, of course, why the Darwinists are very upset trying to undermine the authority of the state board of education. According to those science standards, it demands, calls for, like any science curriculum should, that students learn not only the arguments for any predominant theory or any mainstream theory, but also the arguments against those theories. Any good science education involves evidence both for and against all the major theories. We shouldn't even have to say that, but we have said that in the science standards, and books like Explore Evolution are supplementary books that go alongside the big fat textbooks. The biology textbook, and that's the best thing we have out right now. It's being marketed in public education.
Okay. Because there's a lot of conservative school districts that sort of ignore, you know, the state boards. I mean, not just here in Texas, but, you know, mainly in the South, I guess.
There's probably
some northern ones too. Yeah. I don't know. I know personally of very conservative school districts, and, you know, they're like, well, we're going to pray. I don't care what they say, you know, that type.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing now is with these, the State Board of Education really reaffirmed what had been in place for about 20 years, teaching both evidence for and against Darwinism. That's been there for a long time. But the Darwinists realized that because of recent evidence in the last 10, 15 years, their theory is under such attack now that what they're trying to do is saying that anyone who criticizes Darwinism is doing so for religious motivation, and in fact, any criticism of Darwinism is ultimately religion, which is totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, they've become so... You can tell how desperate they are by how bad their arguments are right now in public forum. I mean, I went down there and testified. I heard firsthand what they're trying to do, and it's ridiculous. It's the total opposite of open, democratic, free exchange of ideas. It's trying to control it. When we're saying, no, we should let students look at the evidence on both sides, you know, and what's the harm of that? It's all for the good. It's for critical thinking skills. Isn't that what we're all supposed to be about? You know, critical thinking skills, not indoctrination in one, what happens to be the majority viewpoint, you know. So, anyway.
But that's exactly what's been going on in this country since the prayer was taken out of the public school. We've gone extremely to that left kind of thinking, like we are politically, or, you know, is the opinions of what the political scene is right now, is that what majority Americans think? I don't know.
I'm going
to want this back on.
And in fact, it might have a warm-up period. It's a good projector. It doesn't have a long warm-up period.
It'll slowly get brighter. Don't worry. If you remember back when you were younger, yeah. Carl Sagan was probably America's most public scientist of the 20th century. Was fond of saying, of talking about the billions and billions of stars and so on. And he says, our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all of this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. So this sort of desperate cry in this vast cosmos, you know, we're just one pale blue dot, as he titled his book. Okay. By the way, he's the one who wrote the storyline for the movie Contact, okay? And he died just before the movie came out. I think it was cancer. He represents what I'm calling the first viewpoint, that life, even intelligent life, is common in the universe. And the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Almost sounds like a liturgy here, doesn't it? Sort of a secular liturgy.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, so... that's the first view. The second view, this first view is also often called the Copernican principle, which is unfairly co-opting the good name of Nicholas Copernicus, the great astronomer, and trying to say that he thought that there's nothing special about the Earth and its place in the universe, which is the total opposite of the truth. He was actually one of those historic Trinitarian evangelical, no, Christians anyway, but he was one of those Christians, okay? He thought that the universe was designed and so on, and the Earth was very special. Anyway, but Carl Sagan is of this mindset. I don't know about now. He's in another place. But, view number two, the rare Earth hypothesis, which is kind of splitting the difference between traditional materialism and design theory. And it's interesting, Peter Ward and his colleague Don Brownlee co-authored this book, Rare Earth, back in the year 2000. And their thesis is that simple life is common in the universe, but complex life is very uncommon. And the reason they think that is because there are a lot of things that have to be just right to have life, particularly complex life, which is what the point of the movie was thus far. So now the third point of view we'll call the Privileged Planet Hypothesis, named after this book, and as I mentioned, there's a movie after that has the same title that goes into more detail than The Case for a Creator does. And here we have a full challenge, full-blown challenge of the Copernican principle, and even of naturalism itself. Naturalism, of course, being the view that nature is all there is. The cosmos is all there is, was, and ever will be, you know, the Sagan thing. And there's two actually theses here. There's the habitability thesis, that is the ability for life to exist, habitability, that life, simple life is uncommon, and complex life also is uncommon. Both are uncommon in the universe. And furthermore, the really striking and really amazing thesis that they've documented with great detail in this book is that the universe is designed for discovery. Not just designed for life, but designed for discovery. And that's a fairly new thesis. There's echoes of that back in the history of science, which is my field, but it's never been developed as thoroughly as in this book. It came out in 2004. And as the video clip explained, scientists are finding, particularly Guillermo Gonzalez, a leading astrobiologist, but a host of others have realized that now that there's this interesting, that the physical conditions that are necessary for life, particularly intelligent life, also make living on Earth a great place to do science, a great sort of platform from which to view the universe and to know the world and to analyze it. Here's my way of depicting this. Habitability correlates with discoverability. That is, having a planet where people like me can live is connected with its discoverability. That is, the ability to make scientific discoveries. And one of the examples in the movie was the perfect solar eclipse. Now, what we have here, of course, a solar eclipse means the sun is covered up by the moon, right? So here we have the moon, and it just so happens that the moon is, because of its size and because of its particular distance from the Earth, perfectly covers up the sun. Now, of course, there's a little variation in how far the moon is from the Earth, depending on where it is in its orbital path. So sometimes solar eclipses are better than other times, right? But overall, you get many, many perfect solar eclipses where it just covers up the solar disk. And of course, the sun is much bigger than the moon, but because the sun is much further away, they both appear the same size, right? And so when that happens, scientists have a rare opportunity to discover lots of things about the properties of light and about the atmosphere of the sun that can only be viewed when that's covered up, when the rest of the sun is covered up, that historically unlock the key to some of the properties of light and analyzing the makeup of other stars that are far away from our own little solar system neighborhood.
Are we seeing gas in that picture?
Yeah, the atmosphere of the sun extends out for a huge distance, and yeah, it's gaseous material that extends out, and as we have analyzed this data, we've learned lots of things about not just about our own star, but we've been able to apply it to analyze stars throughout the entire universe. So this was not just a minor step in the history of science. This was a major step forward in the 19th and 20th centuries as we've made observations during solar eclipses. Yeah.
Is our sun or our star unique?
The traditional party line for materialists has been, well, there's all those billions and billions of stars. Ours is just one of many, and you know, we could have life-bearing planets around just about any of those stars. It turns out that although our star is not totally unique, it's in a very, very narrow class of kinds of stars. And because of its size and because of its mass, it enables us to have a rocky planet that's not too far, not too close. If you have a sun that's much more massive than our sun, then you would have to have the planet for it to have liquid water on it. It would have to be quite a bit further from that sun in order not to be all burned up or evaporated.
I guess the moon's key too, to have a moon.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of factors. Yeah. For example, if the sun were a lot smaller than what it is, Earth would have to be a lot closer to the sun to stay warm enough, right? But you know what happens if you have a planet like Earth that's significantly closer to a sun? Is it gets locked in its orbital path around the sun, and rather than having different faces of the Earth over a 24-hour period facing the sun, it would get locked so that one face of the Earth would always face the sun, and the other side would never face the sun. That would be a disaster for complex life. You could probably still have simple life on a planet like that, living near where it's not too hot or not too cold, but the vast majority of the Earth would be uninhabitable if that were the case. There's a huge list of factors that have to be just right for there to be life on Earth, particularly complex life, but a lot of them even for simple life.
Could Mike comment just quickly for the audience? I just heard about this junkyard explosion concept. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Oh, sort of comparing, let's say, whether it's, let's say, all the conditions needed for life, or maybe all the conditions needed for the first living cell, or whatever. It's kind of like you not only have to have the conditions available, but in the case of life, to actually have life, you have to have all the parts together in the right place at the right time, coordinated in the right way. And what you need is architectural plans. You get the pieces, they're assembled, and then they're also assembled together. And if you go to a junkyard, even if you had all the parts and you had a huge explosion, it's...
And their example was, of course, the aviation. Remember the using the theory if you went to Arizona to the boneyard for airplanes and you had all those pieces, like you're saying?
Right. Even if you had all the pieces, it still doesn't give you an airplane, yeah.
No, they were saying that would be the probability that if you took a nuclear bomb and exploded the boneyard of airplanes, and when the dust settled, you'd have a 747 painted, fueled, and ready to take
off. Right, yeah, okay, sure.
And that puts it in perspective, they're trying to get us to swallow in evolution as far as the possibility of that actually happening is almost scientifically not.
Some of the other examples in the movie, the Earth's tilt is stabilized by having a moon of about the mass and the distance that our moon is from the Earth that helps to stabilize the tilt. Our tilt, of course, is 23.5 degrees, but if we didn't have a moon very similar to the one that we have, then it could radically swing to 60 or even 90 degrees, and any of these would be disastrous for having a stable environment for complex life. So the requirements, for example, for producing a perfect solar eclipse, which is important for scientific insight, which was critical in the history of science for getting a lot of the knowledge we have about the whole universe, is just one of many examples rehearsed in this book, The Privileged Planet, where the conditions necessary for life also make it make Earth a great place to do science from. So the universe is designed, the universe and our place particularly in the universe is designed not just for life, but for discovery itself, for scientific discovery. And they gave example of the, you know, not being too close or too far from the sun. That's called the Goldilocks principle, right? Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Mm-hmm. Scientists actually use these terms, I must tell you, okay? The Goldilocks principle. And then the galactic habitable zone. By the way, in real estate they say location, 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 the three most important things. This is like inner city, really bad, okay? You don't want to live there. In fact, it would be impossible to live in the center of the galaxy because it's too much radiation. You need to be, there's only a certain band within the galaxy where life is possible, and then even there, it doesn't really show up, but there's spiral arms. You want to actually be between spiral arms so that you don't have too much radiation. Plus, you can also see out to see the universe, which was shown the rest of the universe. Otherwise, if you were inside a spiral arm, we would never discover other galaxies. All we would know is our own galaxy. So it's amazing how we've been placed, our time. The thesis of the book says not only are we positioned spatially great for life and science, but also our place in time, in the history of the universe, is fine-tuned for both life and for discovery. It's an incredible argument, amazing argument. And it's well supported by detailed evidence. So it looks like we're putting Earth on a pedestal here for good scientific reasons. It and its moon, which actually isn't that close, it's just there for the picture, okay? Moon's quite a bit distance. If the Earth were a 12-inch globe, the moon would be about a softball, almost the other side of the room, if you want to get an idea of the scale of things here. That's not accurate, but that's just the point. All right, my closing slide is here, and then I'll open up for questions. Notice what have we seen? What can we know about sort of the, if you will, if we open it up to speculating about the character of that designing intelligence behind intelligent design? Again, we have to, if we try to stick with just the science, well, paleontology, I think, does speak to a designer who's doesn't just create everything and then just walk away, but there appears to be repeated instances of designing, of creating. In cosmology, we find, that is the study of the cosmos as a whole and our place in it, we find that our place in the universe is privileged, not only for the possibility of life, but also for the possibility of science itself. And this just sends chills up my spine to think that scientific evidence points to that whoever designed us not only was careful to make sure that we'd stay alive, but also put us in a very sweet spot for doing science itself. I mean, what better? Think of a student, your son who just graduated from high school. What better motivation for doing science itself? This is a scientific discovery that motivates the very discipline of science itself. Intelligent design is not a science stopper. This is a science starter. It motivates us to want to make more and more discoveries. The universe is designed for discovery. So together, what do these two branches of science imply? They imply a designer who wants to be known. Who wants to be known. And I'll close with that. Any questions? Yes, Ken.
You deal with one of your universities, you said, with some young Earth people.
Yes.
I assume you get along.
Yes, we're good friends, good buddies. Not all young Earth creationists are happy about the intelligent design movement, but a good number of them are, and are realizing that we're really making some progress in the broader culture. And I gave Liberty University as an example of one of the leading young Earth creationist universities, and most of their scientists are very happy about the intelligent design movement there.
Are any of them moving toward your acknowledgement of the general age of Earth that's in harmony with the mainstream science?
Well, if they're young Earth creationists, no. I mean, if they think that, I mean, some of my friends who are young Earth creationists think that the Bible requires a young Earth interpretation. I think that's not the case. I mean, I think it's possible. I think the Bible is open to either young or old Earth. Could go either way, theologically. But if they're convinced that the Bible requires that, then what they end up saying is that they hope that the young Earth scientific research agenda will make some progress in years to come, because I think the best young Earth creationist scientists that I know will admit that they've got a lot of work to do to really make a good case, a good scientific case for a young Earth. I think it could be made, but it has been made at various occasions, but I think poorly in many occasions. So I think they've got a lot of work to do, and I mean, I used to be a young Earth creationist myself, so I cheer them on. I hope the best for them. Let a thousand flowers bloom. Actually, that was from Mao Zedong. Anyway, I say let all the research programs go on. I'm all for an open, democratic, free playing field for everyone, including the theistic evolutionists too. Fine, let them do their research. But I think the evidence is strongly leading toward that. Again, the best evidence points to intelligent design. Now, the secondary issue of whether the Earth is old or young, I don't usually speak on that because I think it's a secondary issue. It's not as important. And I've got good friends on both sides.
So you say, what's the yardstick that the young and old people agree is the yardstick?
That we're here not because of an accident, and that God, it sort of, again, go to evolution, faithandevolution.org, and you look. When you look at the arguments for theistic evolution, they're just sort of assuming that the majority viewpoint in science is right. And we have specific critiques of those, and we think that those critiques hold. And so when it comes to the theological, there are some prickly theological issues.
That's not what I meant.
Okay.
I remember being in a seminar about young and old Earth maybe 12 years ago, 15 years ago. I guess the thing I remember from that was that somebody was challenging how the carbon dating
right.
was wrong or whatever.
That's yeah.
what I mean. What's the scientific yardstick that you agree is how you determine age?
Yeah, well, there's a whole...
There is none.
I am not well versed in the physical sciences that are needed to. I have a bachelor's degree in biology, and then my PhD is in history, philosophy of science. But the expertise you would need is in the areas in physics and cosmology that deal with those issues. One of the best old Earth creationists. Organizations, Reasons to Believe in Pasadena, California. They've got a good website, reasons.org. And then the best young Earth creationists, if you want to compare, would be the Institute for Creation Research. They recently moved to Dallas. They were out in Southern California. So you can go and look at what they have, look at their articles, and they've got There's all kinds of stuff that's up there, and you can read it. I'm not personally that interested. I'm not really that interested in that topic. So I really just don't read in that area.
Joe,
so,
just a quick, sorry, but
yeah.
The age, like a young age, what kind of years is the young people?
10,000 to 50,000 years, something like that.
Okay.
And then old, we're talking 15 billion years old for the universe, yeah. And 15 billion years for the universe and about 4.5 billion years for the Earth.
Okay.
So the Earth's been here about, what, about a third of the time of the universe's age. Yes.
Going back to your car example, we had a diversity of design.
Yeah.
The reason we have that diversity is because we've learned from previous designs how to change it or improve it.
Yeah.
So are you implying that God or the designer has been doing this with life forms, improving life forms, and in a sense kind of learning? In other words, God is not omniscient. He's learning himself how to improve his creation.
Yeah, I'm not real fond of open theism, but anyway, I think the idea that God doesn't know the future and he's just kind of wondering like we are what's going to happen next, I think that, but that would be on theological grounds, we'd have to argue that. But as far as what does the science show about the pattern of appearance of life on Earth? What you have is the sudden appearance of major kinds of life, and then multiple times. I highlighted the Cambrian explosion, but there's a lot of events. The Cambrian explosion is the most important event as far as animal life goes. There's also the big bloom, if you will, of plant life much later on, of particularly flowering plants, where there's almost no trace of where they came from. Just poof, there they are. And what you have, though, then is, like I said, even young Earth creationists think that there is a tremendous amount of power, of variability that God built into the initial creative organisms, groups of organisms that he created. He gave them the ability to adapt to new environments. So as the Earth's environment changes over time, they're able to adapt, and new species do arise over time, but within narrow little envelopes of pockets, if you will. Created kinds, if you will, if you're going back to the language of Genesis, created kinds that have, there's a certain plasticity or changeability to them. And I think that's actually a hallmark of forethought, actually, rather than haphazard. Actually, a thing that's so well designed that it can adapt to new situations and change over time, but within narrow limits. Okay, you can only get in the case of artificial breeding, you can only get a dog's nose so long. You're never going to get a dog breed with a nose that's 10 feet long. It's impossible physically. So there are certain limits, you know, to what we can do even artificially with life forms. And God is, I think, it's actually evidence of forethought rather than not knowing what's going to happen next. Yeah.
Now you talk about the words of Genesis. Can you comment briefly on the gap theory and the length of the days, exegetically, what you do with
it? Right.
It's not a challenge. It's
just... Sure. No, it's a friendly discussion here. I think one of the best commentaries on Genesis that deals with that issue is by a guy named C. John Collins. He's at Covenant Seminary in St. Louis. And it's a commentary called Genesis 1-4. He was the, just his credentials, he's a first-rate Hebrew scholar. He was the Old Testament, chair of the Old Testament Committee for the English Standard Version, a recent, you know, very good version. He argues, and I actually use his book as a textbook at the college at Southwestern, he argues for what's called a analogical work week view of Genesis, that there is an analogy between God's work week and our work week. It's very clear in Scripture. Just as the analogy between the body and blood of Christ and the elements of the Eucharist, I know there are some traditions that say that it actually becomes the body and blood of Christ, but I think most Christians would agree that there's an analogy there. It's not an identity. There's an analogy. That's one of the most important analogies in the practice of Christianity, the Eucharist. But I think one of the most important analogies for humanity as a whole is the analogy between God's work week and our work week. God expects us to work and to rest. And he revealed the creation event in the form of a work week, and I think he did actually create and then stop and then create. I think there was, and we find that in the history of paleontology, we have evidence of repeated acts of creation and then not creating. But I would not argue for trying to say that every day in Genesis correlates to a period in Earth history. It's very hard to make that correlation, and I think there's an analogy between God's work week and our work week. There is a general teaching of a progression over time, but don't try to closely ally specific geological evidence with the Genesis account. I don't think the Genesis account was meant to be closely matched with geology history. It was just meant to be that God, we're not here because of an accident. God did this because he planned it. There are repeated acts of creation, and humans are the last creation. I think those are the main teachings of Genesis, and Collins makes a good argument for that. Dembski's book, The End of Christianity, does disagree with Collins on a few minor points, and I agree actually with Dembski. So I don't agree with everything that Collins says, but it's a first-rate commentary. And so between the two books, those are the two best books, I think, as far as the theology of interpreting Genesis.
Gap theory is not something...
I think the gap theory, there's a lot of problems with the gap theory. It was a popular, it was actually the leading fundamentalist Christian viewpoint for a century of time. It was in the Scofield Reference Bible. I think it's based on a misinterpretation of Genesis, and Collins gives all the details. Good. So I think it's a bad theory. Yeah.
Intelligent design was criticized for being just creationism in disguise.
Yeah, in a cheap tuxedo. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes. So, I kind of take that personally. You know, Okay, so go ahead.
Do you have other kinds of audiences that would be either skeptics or non-Christian religions? And do you tailor your presentation to those? Have you had experience with that? And if so, do you just leave the Bible out of your discussion?
Well, again, like I have, if there's anyone here from who was at the State Board of Education who's following me, there might be, I'm sure. Just again, I have no problem being. I'm very public with the point. I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm not trying to hide that. I'm also a design theorist, and I think that I can integrate my Christianity with the findings of science, but there are other people who agree with that. These are the correct conclusions from science who don't agree with my theology, and. Hey, I'm saying, that's evidence that it is a legitimate scientific research program. There's people who are theists, people that are non-theists, all kinds of theists.
Can you help with some of those audiences, though?
I have spoken at various secular settings, secular universities, University of Minnesota, University of Oklahoma, a whole bunch of universities. And as far as religious groups, as far as those away from mainstream Christianity, I haven't spoken to a lot. I mean, I guess this is my first chance to speak to.
Would there be a Jewish group?
I haven't spoken to any Jewish groups yet, but I'm happy if they want to invite me. So, yeah. Yes?
If I may follow up on question or comment, that would be, how would you view then in Genesis, God resting the seventh day? Would that not suggest a 24-hour period?
It's really interesting.
I'm not hearing that.
Sure. It's interesting that, in fact, one of the best arguments for the days of creation not being literal 24-hour periods is the seventh day. Now, here's why. If you look at the structure of the creation week, every day ends with, and there was evening, there was morning, blah, blah, day, except the seventh day. It doesn't end with that refrain. And if you look in John chapter 5, when Jesus heals the blind man by the pool of Bethesda, the Jews persecute him because he was healing on the Sabbath. And he said at that moment, Jesus said, he makes the parallel that he is working now just as his Father is working. And he makes a parallel between the Father's creation Sabbath and his Sabbath on a seven-day format that Jesus... Hey, it's okay to do this kind of work on the Sabbath. Yes, it's work, but it's good kind of work on the Sabbath. And just as the Father, even though the Father, God the Father, is not creating fundamentally new kinds of things now, God is not totally inactive. He's still, the work of salvation is going on, right? So God is doing his work, and I'm doing my work. And so that suggests that the creation Sabbath continues to the present moment. I think the creation Sabbath will end when God restructures the whole universe and creates the new heaven and new earth, that's when his creation Sabbath ends and he starts creation again. So I think it's actually the best, one of the best arguments that the creation days can be interpreted legitimately as not just 24-hour days. And Collins does that in his commentary, the commentary I mentioned. Yes?
Where do you see, you said that, you know, kind of made that analogy at first, that the evolution and Darwinists now are kind of struggling, fighting, you know, fighting for their lives,
yeah,
so to speak, and scared of the intelligent design movement, and trying ways to discredit it. Based, since you're in history, studying the history of science, where do you see, you know, on down the road, where do you see the future in the next 10 years or so? I ask, 10 years I ask because I have a 2-year-old,
oh, okay, sure,
in school and they want to college, you know.
Okay.
Where do you see, you know, do you see the intelligent design movement, mm-hmm, you know, becoming more accepted and more mainstream, yeah, you know, here, hopefully, you know, the next, you know, our lifetime?
Right. Well, we have entered the information age. And I think if you watch the movie Unlocking the Mystery of Life, the way that movie ends, which is the best overall movie on the life sciences part of ID, is we have discovered, on a scientific basis, we have discovered that not only is there matter and energy, but there's also information, and it's non-material. It can be instantiated in different material forms. Just like if I have if I pull out a little flash drive, whether it has data on it or not, it weighs the same. It's the same mass. But if I can load all of my PowerPoint shows and all my presentations on that, it's not going to change the mass of that, but there's information there that wasn't there before. Information is non-material, but it can be instantiated in different material forms. And that's, and I think, so we've entered the information age, not only sociologically, and, you know, kind of the way it hits, you know, computers and so on, but in science too. We're in an age where we recognize that that there's more to existence, to reality, than just matter and motion and energy, matter and energy and space and time. There's also information, and I think that goes back to the cosmic opening to the Gospel of St. John. In the beginning was the Word. God loves to inform, not only theologically, giving his word to tell us about himself, but he's actually informed the world. And thus the image of God the Creator touching DNA, if you will, informing it, giving it the information needed for life to be possible. So God loves to communicate. He loves to give us his word. And the Logos, Jesus, you know, and so on. So, yeah, it's all really fascinating stuff. So I think the future of science is intelligent design. What's going to happen? Is everyone going to become a Christian because of this? No, of course not. I think, again, if you look back in the history of intelligent design theory, there are pagan Greeks who believed in intelligent design. And I think what we're going to find is, I think materialism is old-fashioned now. It's on its way out. And I think... But because the human mind is an idol factory, we tend to create idols. I think that the new kind of idolatry will not be old-fashioned materialism. It will be new age kind of stuff. People are going to embrace design more and more, but they're going to reject the transcendent creator God and say that design is only within the universe, and they're going to go with all kinds of pantheistic and kind of... There's going to be a revival of some of the pagan religions of the past. Sort of, I think, another coming of some dark ages, of chaos, I think, are coming. And but what do we do as Christians and other groups, whatever, what are we going to do? Well, we need to respond to that through I think, exercising the sciences properly, but also answering theological error as well, that needs to be addressed as well. So it's a multidisciplinary response that's called for. Yes?
You mentioned that this Socratic and Platonic continuous view.
Yeah.
That is similar. Would you include Heraclitus in his view of the Logos as the whatever it is that makes what there is an organized cosmos in that same approach?
Yeah, there were... He's referring to one of the pre-Socratic philosophers. So we've got the pre-Socratic philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Okay, that's the lineage there. And Aristotle is our primary source on most of the pre-Socratics because most of their works have been lost. So if you look at what Aristotle and a few other people said about what the pre-Socratics said, all we got is fragments, is there were a number of those who realized there's more to the universe than just matter. And they believed in some kind of mind or logos or organizing principle Socrates and Plato and Aristotle bought into that, and they disagreed with the materialists. There was also materialists pre-Socratics, the Epicureans and Democritus and so on, who argued that there's just atoms in motion. That's it. By the way, one of the best books on relating the classical tradition to Christianity just came out a few months ago by my colleague at Biola University by the name of John Mark Reynolds, called When Athens Met Jerusalem is the title of it, going from Tertullian's famous quotation about what does Athens and Jerusalem have to do with each other, what does classic philosophy have to do with Christianity. But it's a good book on relating the classic tradition, including the pre-Socratics. If you want a great book on the pre-Socratics and how both critiquing it historically and theologically today, how does it relate to Bible and thought today, that would be it. When Athens Met Jerusalem, by John Mark Reynolds. Yeah. Are we done, Ken, or what?
Yeah, well, it looks like about time here. We'll wrap things up in a minute.
Okay.
Could you put your Carl Sagan quote back for us, please?
Sure.
First one, the dismal one about the cosmos.
Oh, okay, sure.
Dismal one.
By the way, you guys are a lively group, a fun group to speak to. So thanks for having me, Ken.
Thank you.
You're a sharp dude.
There's one other Carl Sagan quote.
Okay.
Up there that's very enlightening. I watched him on TV doing the show, and he said, "The universe looks like it's designed, but it isn't."
Yeah, I have an even better one from Crick, Watson and Crick, the co-discoverers of DNA. Mm-hmm. He says, biologists have to keep reminding themselves that life was not designed. In other words, it looks designed. They have to keep reminding themselves it's not designed. It's just an appearance of design. But design theorists say, not only does life appear to be designed, it actually is designed. Yeah. If it looks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Okay. So
one further.
Okay, let me put it on big screen and then... Is it? Oh, this, that one?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, this is wonderful quote here. It's just, yeah. A materialist crying out for salvation, basically.
Yeah. Al Gore's our savior.
Well, we really appreciate that, Dr. Keyes. We're going to begin our program here at 8:30 in the morning.